Have I said anything about slide 10 yet? Okay, that's where we are then. What we're looking at is a couple major categories of cellular work that can be performed. And work requires energy. Work is endergonic, which means you have to supply the energy. Well, often that energy is in the form of ATP, as we've been talking about. But the two categories we see here are transport work and mechanical work. But transport work here would be better called, and I think I said this last time, would be better to call this transmembrane transport, because it's not simply about moving something, it's about specifically moving something from one side of the membrane to the other. It could be either into or out of the cell, but the point here is that it's endergonic because we're moving these things against their gradient. That's why it's work. That's why it's endergonic. That's why you have to supply an outside source of energy. And therefore, what kind of transport proteins are these that we're looking at these in these top pictures? They are carriers, but that doesn't go far enough. They can't be channels, because channels cannot work for the kind of transport operating here. If we're going against a gradient, what kind of transport is that?
Active,
and therefore the transport proteins are what? Pumps. They are carriers, yes, but carriers, remember, can also act passively. Well, this is not passive transport. This is active transport, because we're forcing things against their gradient, stockpiling them on one side of the membrane or the other. So that's transmembrane transport work. Mechanical work in B refers to moving things around in the cell. And we've already talked about these motor proteins, right? They have some sort of cargo, a vesicle of something that they're carrying, but each step of a motor protein along a microtubule requires a fresh ATP to expend. And in both of these cases, both of these are using ATP, the expending of an ATP means what chemically? How do we get the energy out of ATP so that we can drive these endergonic processes? What do we chemically do to ATP to use it? Right. We hydrolyze it. It's a hydrolysis reaction. And that, of course, means that we're splitting something, right? What are we specifically splitting in ATP? The bond between the terminal phosphate and the phosphate that it's connected to. So a phosphate-phosphate bond. And that's going to turn ATP, which is storing energy, into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. That phosphate gets popped off. It's no longer associated with a carbon skeleton, and therefore it's inorganic phosphate. ADP still has some useful energy in it, just not as much as ATP. So that's how we got these work categories done, by using some of that stored energy in ATP. Okay, so in 11... we're looking at a schematic representation of the major role of ATP as an energy-carrying molecule. A lot of books will use the analogy of ATP being the energy currency of the cell. You've probably encountered that definition maybe in high school. So it acts like money. Currency. That's a good analogy for multiple reasons. And that's because money really is an intermediary, a middleman, so to speak, or a middle person. What I mean by that is that no one really works at a job, for instance, whatever kind of work, directly for the things that person needs. Instead, we work, we put our effort into doing our job in order to earn money, which by itself is really worthless, right? We can't eat money, except that money represents that effort, in a sense. And the nice thing about money is that it can be used for a whole lot of things. Whereas if you worked directly for your rent or directly for your food, that's all you would be getting. And all the other things that you need, you wouldn't be able to get, right? Well, if you work for money, then you can spend that money, which represents your effort, on a whole lot of different things. That's a good analogy with what happens in the cell with respect to energy. As we was talking about last time, there are all kinds of endergonic processes that have to occur in order for the cell to remain alive. Endergonic processes, by definition, require energy input, or they're never going to happen. But what cells don't do is what I was just saying humans don't do with their jobs. Cells do not use exergonic reactions that release energy to directly drive the endergonic processes. Instead, what we do is break down fuels, which is a catabolic reaction. When we break down a fuel, we're making it into smaller pieces. That's catabolic, and that goes hand in hand with exergonic, right? That's how we get the energy out of our fuel. But instead of directly putting that released energy into some endergonic process that we're trying to force happen, we capture as much energy as we can from that exergonic burning of the fuel in the form of ATP molecules that get created. So what we directly do with the energy released by our fuels is phosphorylate ADP molecules. Phosphorylate means we stick a phosphate onto them. Okay? That's an endergonic process. It's the opposite of using ATP. Creating ATP out of ADP and inorganic phosphate, hooking them together, creates ATP. And that, it should make sense that that's going to require energy, right? You're making a bigger thing out of smaller things. That, in general, is going to be an endergonic process. But that's what we directly drive with the energy that comes from our fuels. And that's because that ATP now contains energy that was in the fuel, but now it's in a much more versatile form, just like money is versatile and can be spent on a whole lot of different things. It doesn't remain as ATP long because we always have endergonic processes that need to occur. So it's effectively, as soon as we make the ATP, we use it. And by using it, I mean we dephosphorylate the ATP. We do the opposite of what we did to create it. We take that phosphate back off, and that releases the energy, and that energy from the ATP is what directly drives the endergonic processes. So these endergonic processes on the right, they include those categories of work I just talked about. Those are endergonic. But it also includes the endergonic part of metabolism. What is the half of metabolism that's endergonic? Anabolism. So we also need energy from ATP in order to make bigger molecules out of smaller ones, which we're doing all the time. But this is shown as a cycle because really ATP and ADP keeps going back and forth between these forms. That's the middleman I was talking about, the energy broker. ADP and inorganic phosphate receive energy from the fuel. That energizes it into ATP. And then ATP is hydrolyzed back into ADP and inorganic phosphate in order to directly drive the endergonic processes. All right, now to 12. This particular reaction is just an example. So there's the point here is not really the specific example, but you should already know what's going on here. You have sucrose, which is what kind of thing? It's a disaccharide, so it's made of two monosaccharides hooked together. Sucrose is being split here. This is a hydrolysis reaction. You should recognize that, right? And what is being split is the disaccharide into its two constituent monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. In other words, what's happening here chemically is that the glycosidic linkage that holds these two monosaccharides together is being split. This is just an example, but this, along with virtually all other chemical reactions that occur within an organism, in other words, part of its metabolism, happens with the help of an enzyme. The purple name here, purple highlighted name, is a specific enzyme. And notice, well, how can you tell just by looking at this that this is an enzyme? Sucrase. That's right. It's not on either end of the arrow, which would be a reactant or a product, and catalysts, which enzymes are never reactants or products. They help, but they do not get changed into anything. So that's one way. And another way is by the word itself. Not every single enzyme, but many, many enzymes, and there are thousands of different enzymes because they're specific for a specific reaction. Anyway, a lot of them end in ASE, the name. So when you see ASE, that's a good indication that what you're looking at is the name of an enzyme. Also, as far as names are concerned, most enzymes are named in one of two ways. Some of them are named for what they do. For instance, phosphatases are enzymes that take phosphates off of things. Kinases are enzymes that put phosphates onto things. Those are named for what they do. The other possibility, or the second major way in which enzymes are named, is not for what they do, but for their specific substrate. And substrate, as a general word, simply refers to the reactant of a catalyzed reaction. And so what that means is that the substrate is the thing that initially binds to the enzyme in order for that enzyme to help turn that substrate into product. Okay, so substrate is just the reactant that binds to the enzyme. That's where sucrase, the name, comes from. The specific substrate is sucrose, the sugar. This enzyme's named for that. And so an important point of this, well, I've already talked about this in the pathways picture that I showed you in the previous slideshow, is that enzymes are specific. You don't have one master enzyme that can catalyze all of your thousands of different kinds of reactions. You have thousands of different kinds of reactions. You have trillions and trillions of reactions occurring in you all the time. But you actually have thousands of different kinds of reactions occurring. Now, why is it a good thing that you do not have one master enzyme that can catalyze all your reactions? Yes, that would mean all of your reactions would be turned on at the same time. You never want that to be happen. And for various reasons, including that some of these reactions do exactly the opposite of what other reactions do. So you don't want both of those occurring at the same time. You want the appropriate one to be turned on, or ones. So having specific enzymes that catalyze only correspondingly specific reactions gives cells exquisite control over their metabolism. Because remember, even though enzymes are not required for the reaction to occur, the reactions will be so slow without the enzymes' help that they're effectively turned off. All right. Let's continue talking about enzymes in general. This is slide 13. And in the graph, notice, we have free energy versus progress of the reaction. Well, progress of the reaction is just time. Free energy, what's the symbol for that? G. So any individual point on this curve, it has a Y value that is G, the instantaneous value of free energy. This is a thermodynamic system, but this system happens to be, remember, we can define a system any way we want. This system is a chemical reaction. And so this is generic. This is not an actual reaction because A, B, C, and D do not actually denote anything specifically. But notice that you start out with a molecule made up of an A and a B atom and one with a C and a D. They get rearranged into an A and C molecule and a B and D molecule. There doesn't have to be two reactants and two products. It can be any number of either. But the point here with these A, B, and C, D bonds that we have to begin with is that in any given chemical reaction, the reason it is a chemical reaction is because there is a rearrangement of particles, like we've talked about before, meaning that some bonds are broken and new bonds are formed. That's what results in the rearrangement, and then that gives you different stuff, right? The product is chemically different from what you started with, reactant. Okay, now, as far as the definitions I gave you last time are concerned, what kind of reaction is this in terms of what happens with energy? This is exergonic because the value of G final is lower than the value of G initial, right? Therefore, delta G, which represents this range, G is just a point. Delta G is one value subtracted from another. Because G is going down, delta G, which is G final minus G initial, means small minus bigger, and therefore negative number. Delta G is negative. So even if you didn't have the curve to look at, just the fact that delta G is less than zero is labeled should tell you this is exergonic. Now, you could have a corresponding endergonic graph that would look like that, right? The final G is higher than the initial G, and therefore delta G would be greater than zero, it's positive. The main point of this is true whether we're talking about an endergonic reaction or an exergonic reaction. That's why I bothered to draw the endergonic version. The main point here is that in any reaction, whether it's endergonic or exergonic, the reactants don't simply pop immediately into products. It takes some time for that to happen. It can be a tiny, tiny amount of time in some cases. But, like I said, some bonds need to be broken and new bonds need to be formed. And so that doesn't just happen instantaneously. Instead, we have, for a very short amount of time, a substance that's neither reactant nor product. It's called the transition state. It's somewhere in between reactant and product. These wiggly lines represent bonds that are in the process of being broken or in the process of being formed, depending on where it's drawn. Okay, that's why it's not reactant and it's not yet product. Somewhere in between. So all reactions have to go through a transition state in order for products to actually be formed, whether it's endergonic or exergonic. But the important point here, and you can see it in my drawn graph as well, is that the G value, the free energy of the transition state, which you have to go through to get to the products, is higher It's higher than the reactants or the products in both of these graphs, notice. So energetically, the transition state is a hill that you have to get over in order for this reaction to occur, even in an exergonic example like this. When you compare just the products and the reactants, this is downhill energetically, right? That's what exergonic really means. But you still have to climb a hill to get down an even bigger hill. And unless you can get to the transition state, G value, this thing is not going to happen, even if it's exergonic. This explains, by the way, why a reaction like we have here that is going to happen, that is able to happen on its own. That's what we have here. What's another name for that? A spontaneous reaction is one that can happen on its own, but that does not at all mean that it's going to happen anytime soon. This is why you can have a spontaneous reaction that still could take decades before it actually happens, or longer. Much too long for a living cell to wait around for it to happen. This is why we need enzymes. Okay? Some spontaneous reactions happen very quickly because they're easily able to get over the hump. Okay. Now, we're going to look at the same exact black trace in the next slide, 14, but simultaneously we are plotting this red trace. Now, the red trace is exactly the same chemical reaction, same reactants that you start with, same products that you end with, but the red trace represents how this reaction proceeds with the help of an enzyme. And I should have used the previous picture to give you another definition, but I can use this one just as easily. The height of this hill that you have to get over, that is given a special name and symbol. E sub A is the symbol that is short for energy of activation, or simply the activation energy. The activation energy is the magnitude of the activation energy, how big the number is the size of the hill you have to get over, whether it's endergonic or exergonic, for the reaction to proceed to products. And you can see here that E sub A for an uncatalyzed reaction, the black trace, is a much bigger value than E sub A with an enzyme. This, in general, is what enzymes do. This is why they are able to speed up chemical reactions. Because, and there's various ways that they can do it, but enzymes in general do something to make this hill shorter and therefore easier to get over. You can think about some general examples here for how this might happen. For instance, if you have a catabolic enzyme, one that breaks things apart, which would apply to this graph because this is an exergonic reaction. Catabolic reactions are exergonic. To break something apart, you have to stress its bonds. And so that can happen more easily if that reactant, the big chunk, binds to a protein, the enzyme. Because that binding might put stress on bonds in the substrate molecule, the reactant, making it easier to break them apart. If you have an anabolic enzyme, so you're hooking two things together to make a bigger thing. Well, that could happen on its own. Like I said, the enzyme is not necessary. But to do that without the help of an enzyme, these two things would have to not only encounter each other, but they would have to encounter each other in the right orientation? Well, enzymes have active sites where the substrates bind to them. And therefore, if you have a substrate bind, and then the other substrate, the other thing that you're hooking to it, also bind in there, it's going to bring them together in just the right orientation for them to form a bond between them. In other words, to react, to form product. So there's various ways that enzymes individually reduce the activation energy, but they somehow do that in all cases. And therefore, if the hill gets really much shorter than it is without the help of the enzyme, it is a hell of a lot more likely that just the thermal energy of the system is enough to get them over that, and therefore it will speed it up typically millions of times with the help of an enzyme. Now, there's one other very important point about this slide, and that is that an enzyme never affects the value of delta G. It only affects the value of E sub A, activation energy. Right? This part is getting lower. But delta G, by definition, depends only on the G of the products and the G of the reactants. The enzyme never changes that. All right, 15 is a space-filling model of an enzyme in blue and a substrate in red. And any given enzyme has a particular part on its surface with a particular shape called the active site, which is very similar to a lock that has a special shape that will fit only the correct shape in a key. The substrate is kind of like a key that fits into the lock. This is why enzymes are specific. Well, this substrate, recall, is just an example of a ligand. Ligand is the more general term here, right? Because there's all kinds of things that can bind to proteins in general. We call those ligands. When the protein is an enzyme and the thing binding to the protein is going to get turned into something else, then we call that a substrate. That thing that binds to the enzyme is the substrate. But a substrate is a ligand, and therefore when there is a binding event between a ligand and a protein, you should know well now what happens in general. What is that? Right, a conformational change in the protein. Well, there's already, not so obvious here, but there's already a pretty good fit between the substrate and the active site of the enzyme. That's why this enzyme works for this particular substrate. But what's illustrated here with the second picture is that the fit gets even better once the substrate binds to the active site of the enzyme. What we have here is called induced fit. To induce means simply to bring about. Induced fit means that because the enzyme, which is a protein, changes its shape, it wraps around the substrate even better than the substrate did when it first got there. That makes it even more exclusive of the environment. This enzyme is kind of forming a little microenvironment where other things are not going to interfere with it. It's able to do its job of converting that into product easier. This is kind of like the difference between someone who doesn't actively shake your hand, will just put his hand out, and someone who will really wrap his hand around yours when shaking hands. This is a wrap-around handshake, the induced fit. When these two are bound together, they are called, descriptively enough, the enzyme-substrate complex. That's not a permanent structure, obviously, because the substrate is going to soon get turned into product. And we can see that in cartoon form in 16. I think we've already looked at a similar slide, but in general what happens is that an enzyme has a specific shape when it's just by itself, the enzyme, has a specifically shaped active site, which is why it is specific for a substrate or some number of substrates. In this case, two substrates fit in there nicely. Notice that it has an induced fit because this shape is slightly different from this now. That induced fit does something, whether it's straining bonds or whatever, like I said before, does something to decrease the value of the activation energy. And that's what allows the substrate or substrates to turn into product or products. In this case, two products are formed. Well, they don't stay bound to the enzyme once they're products. They detach. And when you detach, well, these are ligands at the moment because they're bound to the protein. When you detach them, then the shape changes back into its original unbound conformation, and which allows it to bind more substrates. This is not a reactant or a product, right? The enzyme does not get used up in the process. Catalysts do not get used up. They get reused. So as long as this enzyme exists and as long as more substrate exists, this will just keep happening, which sometimes the cell wants to happen, sometimes it doesn't. In other words, it's going to be very useful for a cell to be able to control its enzymes, because if you can't control an enzyme, it will continue doing its job since it's not used up. We'll talk about that in a minute. First, let's go to some more graphs. Slide 17. Now, the graph on the top is very similar to the one on the bottom in terms of what is being graphed on the y-axis. It's identical. Rate of reaction. In other words, how fast the reaction is occurring in both top and bottom here, which from the viewpoint of the enzyme means how well the enzyme is doing its job, right? The job of the enzyme is to speed up the reaction. Therefore, the faster it's occurring, the better that enzyme is working. But the conditions under which it's working is what is graphed on the x-axis. Temperature on the top, pH on the bottom. Well, I've mentioned these two variables several times already. They're not the only variables that matter, of course. But protein shape, like I've said before, starting with discussion of acid rain, protein shape is particularly sensitive to changes in these two variables. Other variables can actually change the shape of proteins as well, but temperature and pH are biggies because it doesn't take much of a change in either one of these variables in either direction for the shape to be so drastically changed that it no longer does its job. As soon as you change it at all, is what you see here by the smooth peaks, as soon as you change it in either direction by any amount, either the temperature or the pH, then the rate goes down, the rate of the reaction goes down, meaning that enzyme is no longer doing its job as well. It might still be a high rate, but not as high as the peak, right? And what we see on the top one, which has temperature as the x-axis, is two enzymes of the same type, but from two different organisms that live different lifestyles. So the enzyme corresponding to the black trace is from a human. The red trace is from an enzyme that does the same thing. It catalyzes the same reaction, but in a thermophilic bacterium. Thermophilic means water-loving. These things not only live in temperatures that would kill almost everything else, at the temperature of boiling water or higher even, but they thrive. That's their preferred environment. For humans, though, notice where this peak is. This enzyme works best at 38 degrees, which is average human body temperature. This other one, the red one, works best at high 70s. Well, if you expose this human enzyme to high 70s Celsius, it will totally destroy the enzyme. It'll totally denature it, which is why it goes down to zero rate of reaction. All right? But you can get an enzyme too hot or too cold. There is one temperature that each individual enzyme works best at, and we call it the optimal temperature. Well, similarly, there is one pH, one acidity level, that works best for each enzyme. In the bottom one, these are two enzymes that do the same job, but they're taken from the same organism, a human. These are digestive enzymes. The black one from the stomach. Well, notice it works well at a pH just below 2, which is very, very acidic, right? Exactly what is happening in your stomach, because your stomach produces hydrochloric acid, a strong acid. So it's busy. This happens to be pepsin, an enzyme that breaks proteins down into smaller pieces of amino acids. I mean, smaller strings of amino acids. So it turns proteins into peptides, oligopeptides. Well, that happens for a little bit in your stomach, but then that stuff called chyme that's only partially digested that's in your stomach gets put to the next part of the alimentary canal or digestive tract, which is the small intestine. The small intestine is not acidic. In fact, it is slightly basic. So when you have a sudden change in the pH, that's going to completely destroy, by denaturation, the pepsin enzyme from the stomach. It's no longer going to be working by the time it gets to the small intestine. But that's no problem, because its job is taken up by a similar enzyme that does the same thing, but it works well at this higher pH of the small intestine. This enzyme, trypsin, is secreted by the small intestine itself. All right. Now 18. What we have talked about as far as enzymes today, up until this point, has just been what's represented by A here as normal binding, meaning the enzyme is there, it has the right shape, active site to receive the specific substrate, and if they're both present, the binding will occur, the enzyme-substrate complex will form, and therefore the substrate will get turned into product. That's normal binding. But what I'm bringing up now is what I was hinting at before when I said, as long as the enzyme is still there, it's going to continue doing its job. Sometimes that's appropriate, sometimes it's not. So we have in B a form of inhibition. Inhibition is one half of enzyme control. I mentioned that it was important to control enzymes because controlling enzymes allows the cell to control whether the corresponding reactions occur. It allows control of metabolism. But there's two major ways that you can control an enzyme: turn it off or turn it on. Inhibition refers to turning it off, or at least turning it down. Because you don't have one enzyme, you have millions of copies of the enzyme. This is just showing you one copy. But inhibition is turning it off. The other half, turning an enzyme on, is called activation. Okay, but let's focus on inhibition first. In B, this is not only inhibition, this is specifically competitive inhibition, one type of inhibition. Now, the reason this is called competitive inhibition is because there is a competition between two particles for the same enzyme's active site. One of those competitors, or one of those things doing the competing, is the normal substrate, the teal-colored thing. It is the normal substrate for this purple enzyme, meaning that if it gets in there and binds to the active site, it'll get turned into product. But the other thing in the competition is the blue particle, which is not a substrate. It's called a competitive inhibitor because if it gets into the active site instead of the substrate, which it can because it has enough of a similar shape that it will fit into that active site also, then what it will do is block the substrate. The substrate can't bind to the active site unless the active site is empty, in other words. And a competitive inhibitor is something that can bind to that active site without getting turned into anything. So the competitive inhibitor is not a substrate, or at least not necessarily. In this case, it's not. It simply blocks the active site so the normal substrate can't get in there. Well, if the normal substrate can't get in there, then this enzyme, at least for the moment, at least for as long as it is bound to this competitive inhibitor, is off. It might as well not even exist, right? Because it's not doing anything as a catalyst if its active site is blocked. That's why this is inhibition. But don't think of that as always bad, because sometimes it's appropriate to turn this enzyme off. If you think about the problem of turning an enzyme off because you don't want the reaction to occur at the moment, there's two major ways you could go about this. One of which is simply to destroy the enzyme. Right? If you destroy an enzyme, it's certainly not going to work. The problem with that is that in the very next moment, you might need to have it turned on again. Well, the enzyme you just destroyed is never going to work again. Which means if you want this reaction to occur again, you need to use a new enzyme. You can always make a new enzyme because they are proteins, right? Why are you always able to make proteins? Yes, you have the gene that corresponds to how to build that protein. So yes, it's okay that you've destroyed it. You can make a new one, but that's going to take time and energy to make it. Because a lot of energy, because you have to string together a bunch of amino acids to make it. So it will be much more efficient, in other words, if there is a way to switch enzymes on or off. That way they could still be there, but they would only work when you want them to work. Well, this is switching it off. That's why it's inhibition. And it's competitive inhibition because two things are vying for or competing for that same spot, the active site, on the enzyme. Well, we have an inhibitor in C as well. The red thing is an inhibitor. But this one is not competitive. It is a non-competitive inhibitor, as you see labeled. And that's because it is not binding to the active site, the inhibitor, that is. The red thing can bind only to some other place on the enzyme other than the active site. That still inhibits the enzyme, though. Why? If it's not the active site, how is it inhibiting the enzyme? Because the only place the substrate can bind is the active site. It's still open. Why can't the substrate bind? Well, what is this red non-competitive inhibitor an example of functionally? It is a ligand. And therefore, when it binds, no matter where it binds to this protein, it's going to change the shape of the protein in such a way that the active site, which is not where it's binding, but it's still part of that same protein, changes shape. So the active site will get deformed enough so that even though it's open, the substrate no longer binds to it. It's like temporarily having the wrong enzyme for that substrate, which also wouldn't work, right? It would be like having the wrong lock for the key you have. So that's non-competitive inhibition. Both of these are temporary, because all that has to happen to turn these back on is for the inhibitor, whether it's competitive or non-competitive, to unbind from the enzyme. And then it will either unblock the active site in the case of competitive inhibition, or it will turn the shape back into the correct active site in the case of non-competitive inhibition. So that would turn it back on. Non-competitive inhibition is an example of allosteric regulation. Allosteric here refers to the non-substrate particle binding somewhere other than the active site in order to control the enzyme. Right? But remember, I said there's two ways you can control an enzyme. You can turn it on or off. Well, make sense of this if it doesn't already. If you're talking about a competitive particle, this blue thing, if it's competitive, which by definition means it's binding to the active site, make sense of it in your mind that that can only result in inhibition, right? You can't have competitive activation because it's blocking the active site. You're never going to activate the enzyme if you block the active site. So competitive regulation is always inhibition. But allosteric regulation can be either inhibition, like we see in C, or it can be activation, which should be shown in slide 19. Slide 19 can be either activated or inhibited, or the enzyme can, the purple enzyme, depending on what kind of regulatory particle is there. First, though, before we get to the particles, the green and the red particles are regulators. The enzyme itself is really, in this case, four enzymes in one. What kind of protein would you call this? It's a multimeric protein. Some enzymes are multimeric, and therefore there's not just a single active site. There can be an active site on each of the polypeptides that makes it multimeric. It has quaternary structure. But notice these double arrows between active form and inactive form. These double arrows mean that these two forms are about the same likelihood, and therefore the shape is going to change back and forth between active and inactive many times per second. It's continuously flipping back and forth between these two shapes if it is just the enzyme and that's it. It can only work as an enzyme if it's in the active form, because only then, notice, is the active site the right shape to accept the substrate, which is the blue thing. But it's flipping back and forth it's oscillating between active and inactive forms so quickly that the substrate doesn't get a chance to get in there. Well, then comes the green thing. The green thing here is an allosteric activator. It's allosteric, first of all, because where it binds is not the active site, it's somewhere else. But if it's the green thing, the allosteric activator that's present, the way it binds locks the shape of the enzyme, the purple enzyme, into the active form. It keeps it from oscillating back into the inactive form. And when it's locked in the active form, that means the active sites will keep their correct shape, and the substrate in blue can come along and easily bind to it and get turned into product. So that's allosteric activation. If, on the other hand, you have the red thing, which is an allosteric inhibitor, it will bind differently to the enzyme, which will lock it into the inactive form. And as long as that red thing, the allosteric inhibitor, is present, is bound to the enzyme, that enzyme is taken out of commission. It's turned off temporarily. But that's better than destroying it, because all you have to do is pop it off again and you have an enzyme already in place. You don't have to build a new one. Much quicker and much less expensive. Okay. Now to 20. This still has to do with enzymes, but what we see here is an example of feedback inhibition. And feedback inhibition is a very efficient way of turning off a biochemical pathway. Remember, any biochemical pathway is a serial or end-to-end arrangement of chemical reactions in which the product of one, the first one feeds the, serves as the reactant for the second, which gets turned into a second product, and so on, for however many steps there are in the pathway. So this is a real pathway here, even though the specific example doesn't really matter, but you start with the initial substrate, threonine, that's the input into the pathway. But the first reaction simply turns it into an intermediate, intermediate A. It's called an intermediate because it's not the final product of the pathway. It's not what the cell wants at the end of the line. It's just something that has to happen in order to get to the second reaction and so on. So you have a bunch of intermediates, and as you should expect at this point, each individual reaction requires its own specific enzyme for just that step of the pathway. So the enzymes' names aren't given, they're just labeled enzyme 1, 2, 3, and so on. The final product, though, is isoleucine. And isoleucine doesn't really matter, just to explain it. Isoleucine is an amino acid. The same concept would be true for other pathways. But the point here is that the cell needs isoleucine under certain conditions, and it can make it via this pathway, starting with threonine. Well, when would it be appropriate for the cell to have this pathway turned on? But don't overthink this. Exactly, when it needs isoleucine, which is not all the time. All right? So this is feedback. So we've talked about feedback already. Remember the concept of errors when it comes to feedback, right? An error is how far away from what you really want. So there's an error involved here as well. But yes, you're right. If the cell needs isoleucine, it's appropriate to have this pathway turned on. And if the cell does continue to need isoleucine, then as long as it gets produced, it's going to be used by the cell. So as long as the cell continues to need it, isoleucine is not going to build up, because it's being used by the cell for whatever purpose. But when it eventually has enough isoleucine, the pathway will still run, simply because these enzymes are still working, right? They're not trying to do anything, they're just chemicals. So as long as you still have threonine, whether you still need isoleucine or not, the pathway will run. But in the case that the cell has already used the isoleucine that it needs, that means this additional isoleucine that gets produced is going to accumulate. And that is the error. The error in this case is too much isoleucine. Well, this problem solves itself via feedback inhibition, because isoleucine itself acts as a competitive inhibitor, an inhibitor of some sort, but in this case, an allosteric inhibitor. Okay, so this is this first enzyme. If isoleucine becomes more and more prevalent in the cell because it's not being used, its concentration is going up. In other words, if that happens, then the higher the concentration, the greater the likelihood that isoleucine will encounter one of the enzymes in this pathway. And it's able to bind to the enzyme as an allosteric inhibitor. Isoleucine binds, that changes the shape of the protein, deforms its active site, and therefore threonine can't bind to it. Now in this case, this is true in most cases, it's the first enzyme in the pathway that gets inhibited. Even though you could solve the problem being producing more isoleucine when you don't need it, you could solve that problem by turning off any of the enzymes, not necessarily the first. Why does it make sense, though, to turn the first one off if you don't need the final product?
Because if you turn off the first one, you won't even have the halfway steps in between. You won't have unnecessary...
That's right. The only reason you're making these intermediates is for the ultimate goal of producing isoleucine. If you don't want to produce any more isoleucine, why go through the expense and the time of making these other intermediates when they're just going to get to a dead end? So it's much more efficient in terms of time and energy to nip it in the bud and turn off the first enzyme. That's typically what happens. Okay, so that, does it make sense that that's going to turn it off? That's going to... If you turn off enzyme 1 here, as has happened because isoleucine itself binds to it to turn it off, that is going to shut off further production of isoleucine, right? That's only part of the problem, though. There's the other problem that you already have too much isoleucine on hand. But at least you're not going to add to it, right? Well, that little bit of extra isoleucine, or however much extra isoleucine you had before this occurred to shut it off, that isoleucine is valuable material still. It might take a while for it to be needed again. And when, whether it's the next moment or hours later or whatever, when the cell needs more isoleucine, it will start using up the isoleucine that's already accumulated. That means the concentration is going to go down in the cell. And when the concentration gets low enough, then the isoleucine molecules that are hooked to the enzymes, keeping them turned off, will diffuse away from them. They'll pop off and move away, and that will automatically turn those enzymes back on because they will assume their correct active site shape again. And as long as you have substrate, threonine, this will turn the entire pathway back on, which would be appropriate because now you need more isoleucine again. So it's self-regulation by feedback inhibition. Let's see whether we're done with this chapter. We are indeed. All right, I still have some time, so we'll go a little farther.